Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Above Politics Show. I am Justin Case.
And I'm Martin Bain.
Today we'd like to talk to you about a holiday that's about to be celebrated here in the United States. This is our July 4th Independence Day, and it is intended that we should look back and remember the American Revolution, stop to think about what that means for us as a society today, and then ponder how we're going to use those important civics lessons for the future. Aside from the fact that I want to know if you guys still have sour grapes about this whole thing, I'm very interested to know what your take on the subject is here in 2008.
I suppose my first view would be, I know sort of plenty of Americans who sort of see this as a war of independence. I suppose from an English or stroke British perspective, we wouldn't see this as a war of independence. We'd probably see it as a war of succession, potentially fought by terrorists and rebels and renegades, insurgents, whatever you want to call them, who things hadn't gone as they did. If the British and their allies had succeeded, the founding fathers would probably have been rounded up and executed as traitors. I suppose that's about as black and white as we see it. I just don't see it in the same light that you do, because you see it as the key defining moment of the foundation of the United States of America. I see it as a bunch of renegades, as a bunch of terrorist insurgents fighting, and it's not a war of independence as far as I can see it.
Now, I'm interested in the term you used, war of succession. Can you try to fine-tune that definition a little for me?
Let's not get away from it. The British Empire was the colonial power. It had ruled through force of arms for hundreds of years, fighting the French and no doubt fighting the native people and the Spanish across the whole the North America continent. And we were the colonial power. So therefore, I suppose I always see it the other way around, is that, you know, it's not a war of independence for me. It's a war of succession. You are trying to succeed or secede away from the British Empire. I mean, that's basically how I see this war, Justin. You didn't want to be ruled and subjugated under the British Empire, so therefore you were fighting a war to gain independence for your country. But I wouldn't see it like that one, because I see that as you're trying to secede away from the rule of the British Empire.
Now, it's interesting you make that point, because approximately 80-odd years after the Revolution, we end up in our Civil War, in which the Southern Confederate States made their case for seceding from the Union, and the Northern politicians, Abraham Lincoln in particular, made a very strong case for the anti-secessionist argument. And of course, you know, the entire war was fought, the South was lost, the Union remained whole, and that's how we tend to think of that today. So you could be right there. There's one thing for sure. If the British had won out in the colonies, however they did it, you and I certainly wouldn't be having this conversation.
No, and there are plenty of people who no doubt are much more intelligent at trying to surmise what may or may not have happened. I don't think we may not have been having this conversation. It might have been that I would be speaking from potentially the colonial power, and you would be speaking from one of the colonies. I mean, I don't sort of see, the way the world evolved wouldn't fundamentally have got sort of from a technology point of view and maybe a sort of social point of view, it would have got to where it is today. It just might have been the swings and balances, you know, and we've had many events since 1776. You know, you talk about your Civil War, you know, you talk about, you know, wars in Europe, you talk about, you know, the Great War, you talk about the Second World War, you talk about the Cold War. We could certainly pontificate for hours on whether those would have happened or not. So I suppose I would see us still having a discussion about something that maybe happened in 1776, maybe, you know, the American colonies claiming independence and being subjugated, and, you know, from an English perspective, maybe us celebrating the fact that all the, what, how we see them, traitors were executed. So we might have had a traitor's day or an execution day, rather than, say, you now celebrating Independence Day on the 4th of July, we might have celebrated Traitor's Day on the 4th of July instead.
Boy, that's something to think about.
Hello, everyone. I'm Spencer Tracy. Along with Doc Hancock, I host the new BTS Mix Show. We have a lot of fun, and when we're done with our shows, we like to head over and listen to our sister shows, the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous, and the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case on the Above Network LLC. The ATS Mix Show with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous is the source for the latest information on breaking stories, conspiracy theories, and some stuff that's just plain weird. Johnny and Dave have insightful discussions about member posts, member interviews, and exclusive interviews with experts in their field. When I need the latest news and insight from the political arena, I log on to the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case. Martin and Justin really break it down for me. They discuss member posts, interview members about their stance on the issues, and they have access to today's noted political figures and authors. So come on over and deny boredom with me, Spencer Tracy, and my co-host, the marvelous Doc Hancock, on the BTS Mix Show. Deny ignorance with the ATS Mix Show with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. And deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case. Be part of the revolution. The Above Network LLC.
When I look at what the ringleaders of the revolution did and the risks that they took, from their point of view, it was not a sure thing. They had laid everything on the line, and in many cases, if you look at their personal writing, they fully did expect to get that knock at the door in the middle of the night, and they fully did expect to be arrested and executed at some point. So I'm sure that especially after the ink dries on the Articles of Confederation, which takes place before the Constitutional Convention and all that, those guys must have been thinking, wow, man, we are on such a roll. I really wonder how this turns out.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting thing, but I suppose you only have to look through history, Justin, and say, I'm trying to think of a good example where a colonial power has subjugated a people for a considerable period of time and there has not been some rebellion or insurgency or war of independence. Because, you know, if you look at this from a sort of a military point of view, this was a battle that probably the British were hard pressed to win. It wasn't on home turf, for example. It was thousands of miles away. Communications weren't exactly as slick and as speedy as they are today. Most of the soldiers would probably have been press ganged anyway from Britain. You know, you were taking young men out of their very comfortable environments, putting them on a ship. It probably wasn't very nice on that ship. You were sending them 3,000 miles by sea to fight a war in a strange land against a people. And this was their homeland. So I suppose you have to see that as well, in that, you know, if you see it from a military point of view, it was probably Britain's war to lose fundamentally more than, say, the American people's war to win, because they had the advantage of it being on home turf. They knew the terrain. They were fighting for something intangible, something in their heart, whereas the vast majority of the British were fighting because they had taken the monarch's shilling and were fighting for the monarch. They were fighting for money.
Well, the difference between the two militaries is very striking. And the only reason I think that it was even possible for the Continental Army to exist was because of the environment that existed before hostilities broke out. In the early 1770s, there's a series of hostile laws come out of the Parliament, the Stamp Act, etc., the various tea taxes, the whole thing. And again, because you mentioned the slow speed of communications in those days, I don't actually think it was possible for the average parliamentarian in Britain to grasp the consequences of their actions. I think if they had been able to get some idea of the speed with which they were pushing the colonists to make their decision, they might have relented and things could have turned out differently. But
I would suspect that the members of the British Parliament at that time really wouldn't have cared much what the Americans thought, whether they were passing legislation that was inciting them, they would have said, well, we're the parliament, we make the laws. They would have looked to the military and they would have said, well, it's your job to enforce it. So I don't think, even if we had had faster communications here, Justin, that a vast majority of the MPs who were, you know, typically all men, typically well-to-do people, they would have probably been landed, they would have been gentry, you know, it would typically not have been voted for by the masses or a much more democratic process as we see today. They wouldn't have cared what a group of people in America were saying, and if they were moaning and whinging about, you know, a particular act being unfair, unpleasant, costing them money, they wouldn't have cared in the slightest. I don't think that would have actually changed their viewpoint, because the MPs in Britain wouldn't have been interested. They say, well, you're a colony, we tell you what to do, you do it. If you don't like it, we send our army in, we break a few heads, you do what we say anyway. So I'm not sure it would have changed anything.
You're probably right, because the people who would have been in a position to complain to Parliament would have been the business owners. They would have been the various heads of the Crown-sanctioned trading companies. And the situation in North America is starkly different from what you have in other parts of the empire. In, for example, India, there are huge, massive, monolithic business interests over there. They're very well represented. And they had a louder voice at the time, I think, than the American business community had at that point. So even if there were the occasional letter that went back to the parliament to apprise them of the situation, I think they most certainly would have not given it very much weight at all.
And I think you touch on something fundamental here, that were the people in the middle who might have been interested in the fact that, you know, the colonies in the Americas were feeling under pressure, would they have actually cared that much? Because all they would have done is put their prices up and charged more a profit in the middle. So I don't think, again, they would have cared that much, because they'd have said, well, tough, if it cost this amount now, it's going to cost this amount in a month's time, because we've got a new tax. And they would have still made their profit, and it would potentially have been the local people in the Americas who would have suffered for this. It wouldn't have been the people in the middle, because they'd have just upped their prices and made the same amount of money. And no doubt the people in Britain who were giving patronage to these trading organizations would have been getting their percentages. So I don't think they would have cared anyway.
Right. Now, one thing that strikes me as being interesting here in 2008, the price of everything is going up. We've just had massive flooding in our country's breadbasket, Iowa, Kansas, Indiana, etc. So vast amounts of our corn and wheat crop, it's all gone. So now we're going to have to replace this by imports from other parts of the world. And I can already speculate now that a lot of people are going to be very frustrated, because they're going to feel like they're at the mercy of outside interests, much the same way they do every time they go to the gas pump and shell out, at this point, $4.50 for a gallon of gas.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is interesting how you can see parallels from what happened, you know, in the 1770s, you know, in 2008. I suppose we need to sort of go on record here to say there are a lot of things very different from the social and political climate today to being in the 1770s. But yeah, can one start to look back is always a very good thing here, Justin. But you know, are we seeing a sea change in the way the American people think and act, similarly to what they did in 1776, where many of them were prepared to say, I'm prepared to put my life on the line to fight for an independent country? Are we, you know, are there starting to be similar parallels in how American people are thinking today, that they want to go back to being a much more democratically represented country rather than in the interest of big business?
Well, I don't think that militancy is here yet, but I do think the frustration is starting to emerge. Back in November of 2006, the Republicans got quite the shock when voters went to the polls and voted for the Democratic opposition in record numbers. Even in contemporary terms, never mind the historical curve, the GOP got spanked, and they got spanked hard. And interestingly enough, if you look at the contemporary political situation, there are a lot of voters who are just shaking their heads because they're saying, wow, man, these guys didn't learn their lesson in 2006. Here we come, November 2008, going to have to go back to the polls, going to have to do it again. Must express our dissatisfaction.
And clearly, the American people today have a totally different mechanism to express their dissatisfaction with their government, whereas in the 1770s, no one in Britain would care if they didn't like what was going on in Parliament or how they were being taxed or subjugated or abused or picked on, stolen from, abused, misabused. No one would have cared. If someone had actually made the trip across the Atlantic and had managed to even get anywhere near the Houses of Parliament to even make their case, most people wouldn't have even been interested in listening. So at least today, you can see that 1776 and the independence at least gives the American people the ability to actually have a voice in how they are governed, whereas in the 1770s they really didn't have a voice.
Conditions have changed so much in both of our countries that it's incredible. I mean, here you and I are doing this show, and while we may not be able to get the big names, we have the luxury of being able to look up a telephone number, and we can talk to members of staff from a wide range of political parties, and we've obviously interviewed people from a wide range of political parties on this show, and we've done it with such a relaxed ease that I think that any of our counterpart from the 1700s, they wouldn't have believed us if we told them, you did what?
Exactly. I mean, I can imagine there would no doubt have been communications going across the Atlantic. Orders would have been coming from, the military in London, in the UK, and reports would have been going back. And I suspect those reports might have taken weeks to make their way. I mean, once they got to the port, if you say had to send, orders through up country, so to speak, that could take weeks. So, from a date an order was cut, say in Britain, to maybe it being received by a commander of a camp or a fort somewhere 4,000 miles away, it could be 6, 8, 12, 20 weeks, and the whole climate, the whole military situation, the whole political situation could have swung round 10, 15 times. And the commander gets an order, says, you will go and do this one. Well, yeah, they were there 7 weeks ago, but the season's changed. It's now winter. I'm not going to be leaving my camp because, A, I don't want to freeze to death. I've got all my provisions. So, you're absolutely right. Communications would have been probably very, incredibly difficult. And, that probably, why sort of battles were probably fought at certain times of the year. And you sort of talk about, the political and military climate, the British, hence why they were called redcoats, because that's what we wore. It's not like today where, if you're in an environment, you wear camouflage. Anybody could have seen the British soldiers coming in. I'm sure, there's always been talk about this one that, the way that the Americans fought their war was probably unknown to a degree to a lot of the British commanders at the time, who had fought very regimented wars, almost sort of wars by sort of letter. We will meet you at so-and-so at this time and we will start war then. It still was very regimented in the fact that the British soldiers wore red coats, so they could be seen for miles.
The contrast between the two sides at the time couldn't have been starker just for that one reason. Now, it's worth pointing out to our listeners that the American soldier at the time did not invent guerrilla tactics as they were used. As a matter of fact, a great many of the officers, the people who held the higher ranks in the Continental Army, they had participated in the previous decade in the French and Indian Wars. So all of the commando-type tactics, the guerrilla rushes, the whole thing, all of this they learned in the Canadian territories because the conditions were very harsh, large formations were just not possible, and if all you had was a handful of guys and your bare knuckles, then that's what you used.
Exactly, whereas I suspect the British mentality was, I will send a regiment and they will line up and, sergeant majors will no doubt shout orders from, orders that have come down from gentlemen who are sitting on horses probably some distance away with runners, and that was probably a fairly interesting military lesson. Yeah, again, you go back to communications. it would have taken weeks for anyone to find out that maybe a unit or a regiment had been slaughtered or had been severely hit, and and then people might not have believed what the soldiers, the survivors, were saying, that, you know, these people came out of the woods and they came out at night, or they didn't show themselves, you know, we couldn't, you know, deploy in the traditional tactics. So, you know, it was probably, not only was it a war of independence for the American people, Justin, but it was probably also a war of military change for the British Army, you know, who were maybe exposed to a new way of fighting that they hadn't seen before.
You can also make the same case here in 2008. The U.S. and British forces, which have been active in Iraq and Afghanistan, they've completely altered their playbook. If you look at the equipment that's deployed today versus what was deployed 5 years ago, both armies have learned substantial lessons. They've modified their tactics, and now they're much more suited to those environments than they were when they first arrived in country.
The only sort of thing I might say there is that probably the cultural shock of that was probably less for some of the British Army, because we've been fighting, a homegrown terrorist organization in Northern Ireland for many years. I still accept your point, but I think the culture shock for the British Army was probably less than the culture shock for the American Army, who, you know, traditionally have, you know, been able to wade in with huge resources, you know, be able to call on vast amounts of firepower. And, you know, and some of the insurgents were, had probably studied that and understood that. And I think, and it's, you know, interesting to sort of contrast 1776 and maybe what's going on with Iraq today. And I know a couple of the posts on a thread that we put up to let our members know we were planning to do this, Justin, so said you can't really compare what was going on with the British and the Americans in the 1770s and what's going on with Iraq today. Well, I slightly disagree with that one, because history is the best guide we have, but you could flick it round and say, what is the difference between the insurgency in Iraq today and the freedom fighters, as you would see them, fighting the British? It's perception that changes that view. It's nothing else. It's the fact that we look into Iraq and see ourselves as going in there to help them, whereas the insurgents may be looking at us thinking, hang on a minute, there's no difference to the occupation forces that the British and the Americans are putting into Iraq today to maybe how the founding fathers thought of the British Army and its allies in the 1770s.
Well, actually, when I think about the culture shock that may have taken place in the 1770s, what I'm thinking of is the fact that for the average colonist and for the average British soldier, they must have been scratching their heads at times thinking, what in the world are we doing? Because we look alike, we sound alike, we dress very similarly, we have most of the same concerns. There are plenty of documented instances in which we have letters that go back and forth between family members. You have somebody who happens to have a cousin in the British Army, and so he writes to him and says, this is what it looks like from my side of the fence. What is going on? And the British soldier writes back to his American cousin and says pretty much the same thing. And I'm sure there must have been days when everybody got together after some kind of an engagement or something, maybe exchanged mementos, whatever it was they did in those days, and they must have just said, why are we?
And that's a parallel that you could take across the world. And it comes down to the leaders of our countries in the 1770s and today making decisions that the ordinary people, and you have to think that, most of the British who fought in the Americas in the 1770s did so because they were in the army, whether they'd been conscripted or whether they joined up themselves. It was their duty, and I'm sure the same could be said of the revolutionary people who joined the army. They were there. Some of them may have been there fighting because they wanted to, free their country, but I'm sure many of them would have been fighting because, well, it probably meant that they actually got some food, they got some clothes, and it was probably a fairly nice, is not the best word, but it probably had some, their life probably had some structure. So a lot of them were probably just fighting, as you quite rightly say, well, because this is what I was told to do. Oh, and the guy who's shooting at me, as you say, looks the same, speaks the same language, has the same concerns as me. Absolutely. It's the leaders of the time who are making decisions And I suppose one of the big differences here, I hope, is that the leaders today are more accountable to the people, and the fact that, you know, the US people are going to be having a general election. Whilst they can't exercise an opinion on the president, they can certainly exercise opinion on his party. Whereas in the 1770s, the people of Britain wouldn't have sort of been able to exercise any political control over the government of the time. Most of them probably couldn't read, couldn't write. Most of them probably didn't have much of an education. You know, they were scrabbling to live on a day-to-day basis. So they really didn't care whether the government was fighting a war in the Americas, or was fighting a war in Africa, or was fighting a war in the Far East or Middle East. Most of them were probably more interested in, well, where's my next meal coming from?
Well, it's interesting also to recall that there were laws in both places at the time. If you had said a bad word towards a colonial governor, or even some of the lower-ranking colonial officials, that was a jailable and finable offense. And there were similar laws in effect in Britain at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, if you said something unpleasant against the king or the queen, or, you know, a senior official, absolutely. To a degree, do some of those, I suppose I'd turn around and say, maybe the law has changed a little bit, but, you know, we talk about protest, for example, and I'm sure it's the same. I'm not sure whether it's the same in the United States, but many people would believe that our rights of and our ability to protest have been taken away, because now you have to give more notice and you have to be more controlled. And there are certain places in the United Kingdom, particularly around our House of Commons and our House of Lords, there's some very large green land, or some greenland around it. And you can't protest there without permission from the government or the police. And you think, well, that's a bit of a mockery, because, you know, protest typically isn't planned. I mean, you have to think the American revolutionaries, you know, didn't sort of, you know, present a formal request to the British government, say, well, you know, we are going to have a protest and then we're going to have a war. It probably spiraled, you know, little action, bit of response, bigger action, more of a response, and all of a sudden you've got two peoples going at each other, their leaders fighting for what they think is right and proper, and the people actually doing the fighting thinking, well, I've been told to do this, I'm just going to go and do it.
Well, there's a lot of indication from the records of the period that the members of the Continental Congress, the Founding Fathers as we know them today, they never actually thought it would go to revolution. They started their correspondence campaigns. When things go so far as the Declaration of Independence, a great deal has come before that. And most of these guys said to their spouses and to their friends through private correspondence, ha, okay, we're going to call their bluff with this declaration thing, but we expect to be home by the end. And they were just totally amazed when, in effect, the crown called their bluff and the whole thing goes to war. Then they have to convene, then they have to pass the hat, and then the whole appointment of George Washington as commander-in-chief comes around. And part of what gets him put in charge is, you know, George is politically reliable. If they haul him off and hang him, he's really not going to take too many of us with him. So let's appoint that guy to run the army.
I suspect the reason why the bluff was called, I think, probably two reasons. One would have been the sort of the feeling among many of the sort of political elite in Britain at the time of, you know, what are these upstart colonialists doing, you know, daring to, you know, even think about wanting independence. And I suspect the other one was purely financial. You know, there are a lot of people who were probably growing very wealthy off the fact that, you know, the Americas were colonies and they had rights to the land there, they had rights to the resources there, you know, they probably had rights to the people. So I suspect it was that pure, you know, the vanity thing of, well, hang on a minute, these damned Americans, how dare they? And then also money, greed. I think those would be the monarch at the time would have been being told what to do by the trading organizations.
Hi, everybody. This is Dave Rabbit.
And I'm his co-host, Johnny Anonymous. And we do a show called The ATS Mix on AboveTopSecret.com. You know, after Dave and I get through doing one of our shows, We like going and listening to one of our sister shows on the Above Network, LLC.
And you know, Johnny, one of my favorites is over on BelowTopSecret.com. It's the new and hilarious BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock, his partner. When you're looking for lighter entertainment, these guys will rock your world with the best of sports, news, television, radio, and general discussion.
Oh, good.
They feature member posts, member on-air conversations, and celebrity interviews. This is a show that everyone is really going to enjoy.
And if by chance politics might be more your cup of tea, then AbovePolitics.com is going to be right up your alley. You know, the Above Politics show features Martin Bain and Justin Case, and they give you insightful and informative information that you're just not going to find anywhere else. They feature intelligent conversation on posts from our members, member interviews about their stance and platforms, as well as interviews with noted political figures and authors. You know, Dave, this really is your one-stop political shop.
And you're right about that, Johninator. So come join us all. Deny ignorance with Johnny and I on the ATS Mix Show.
Deny boredom with the BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock.
And deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with our friends Martin Bain and Justin Case.
And then you, too, can be a part of the revolution. Above Network LLC.
One of my favorite events of the entire revolution is after the after you have the initial confrontation with General Gage and the militia at Concord. There's a brief interval before he begins to march towards Lexington. And so the people there, they have 24 hours to digest what just happened in the town next door. They get together at the local tavern, and they hash this over. And a lot of what we get out of the diaries and the correspondence from the period is just how torn they were, because they said, how dare we bite the hand that feeds us? How dare we do this? And ultimately, they worked it out for themselves. Well, you know, as a matter of fact, we dare to do this because of X, Y, and Z. So the handful of militia soldiers that go out to that go out to Lexington Bridge to face down General Gage and his troops, these guys, they go with the belief in their hearts that, you know, we're going to die, but this is worth it. And that's a lot hard for many people in today's world to get, because when you have the TV remote in one hand and the bag of chips or the glass of cola in the other hand, it's hard to think that anything is really worth dying for.
Oh, exactly. But, you know, I suppose we have to turn around and say, you know, you can go back clearly to what we said earlier. You know, the political climate was substantially different. But one of the things that I suppose it always interests me is just how much of this was a spontaneous act by the colonists. You know, I mean, you know, and I'm sure from a sort of education point of view, this is seen as, I assume from an American perspective of, you know, some people got together and said this was wrong, oh, we must fight the British. But I just wonder how much of this was fueled and financed. Well, I certainly know it was significantly financed by the French and the Spanish and maybe even some of the Dutch. So it's always interesting to me, and I don't know whether this is spoken about in the education rounds of the War of Independence, Justin, about, well, you know, just how much of this was pushed and prompted by other European powers.
The European powers really didn't make a decision to meddle in the conflict until after it was underway. But if you stop and consider that everything could have changed in that one confrontation. When the British troops arrive at Concord, they dress ranks, and somebody comes out and they read the official writ that gives Gage the authority to do what he's doing. And at that point, it was altogether possible, if the guy had said, okay, now all of you lot just clear out and go home, it's possible that they could have done it. And if that would have happened, it would have been such a history-changing dynamic that the people in the next town, which is where Gage was going, they probably wouldn't have thought twice about resistance. But because they hear the tale of the shot heard round the world, to this day, nobody knows who pulled the trigger. It could have been the British, it could have been the it could have been the militia. My money says it was probably some nervous guy in the militia. He probably didn't intend to do it. He just got a little too nervous and twitched at the wrong moment.
Or we can throw the conspiracy thing right into all of this one and say it was probably some French or Spanish person who was in the middle of all of this one and thought, I know, I'll start a war which will help Britain take their eye off what's going on in the rest of the world, and therefore the French or maybe the Spanish empires can continue to expand and have less of a threat from the British Empire. Now, there's a nice conspiracy theory to throw into all of that.
Oh, boy. Now, if I can ask, what were you taught about these events in school as you were growing up?
Many years ago when we used chalk and slate, no doubt, for me to write on rather than paper. I suspect, and I'm just trying to drag my memory back here, so the whirring sound is the cogs in my brain working. I don't recall us having a great deal. It might have taken a lesson, maybe a 40-minute lesson. We might have spoken about it in a 40-minute lesson, if that. It would certainly have been part of British history, and the fact that, you know, we lost the Americas.
Might have been swept under the rug?
Yeah, we lost the Americas, but then Britain went on to have, you know, one of the world's largest empires. You know, it wouldn't have taken, if we'd have spent 40 minutes on it in the course of my education at school, I'd have been surprised. Now, flicking it round, Justin, I suspect that your education might have focused on, you know, the events, you know, of 1776, but, you know, coming up to 1776 and then after 1776, I suspect they may have taken slightly longer time in your education.
Oh, yes. From first grade all the way through sixth grade, we got the Founding Fathers, the Revolution, Lexington conquered, the shot heard round the world, surrender of Cornwallis, the whole burrito time and time again, and it was given to us in a very reverential fashion. We were taught very much to appreciate it. We were reprimanded when we didn't appreciate it, and I say that from experience because I was the kid in class who had the temerity to raise his hand and say, excuse me, but what about blah, blah, blah? And so, aside from the fact that I got to know the corner very well, it was an interesting thing to me because that was the one subject of all everything else they taught us, reading, writing, arithmetic, the whole thing. That was the one verboten thing. You did not question what they told you.
But interestingly, you know, if you, from my perspective, Justin, you think of the only person that most people in Britain could recall even learning anything about the American War of Independence, it would be George Washington. That would be it. I don't, you know, if you asked other people to talk about some of the other political leaders, some of the other military leaders, I don't suppose anyone would be able to name them. And certainly, I'm absolutely positive that if you took someone who had just finished, you know, school, rather than going on to higher or further education, they wouldn't have been able to tell you who any of the British commanders were. Washington would be the only person, you know, and that's probably, you know, more about some of the stories when he was younger and maybe when he was much more the de facto leader of the American Republic. That's what people would remember. They wouldn't remember anything else. And if you actually asked people to sort of, you know, give you even a brief chronological history of the American War of Independence, you know, who sided with the Americans, who sided with the British, I would suspect 99% of the British people wouldn't be able to answer that question for you.
Well, that's the same way here in the United States. Now, I have a background in history. I've got a degree in the subject, so I'm very familiar with the narrative. I like the story just because from whichever side you choose to look at this thing, it has so many ups and downs. And, you know, as long as we're here in 2008 looking back, I'd like to point out that Hillary Clinton lost her bid for the presidency. But back in the late 1770s, British General Sir Henry Clinton also had to pack his bags and go home.
It's not over until the lady in the pantsuit says it is.
Oh, now I wonder if they're related.
It does make you wonder. At the very least, you can say that the Clinton name hasn't had a good track record so far in the last 240 years.
Oh, I that's probably slightly unfair. I mean, I think President Clinton, you know, I'm going to jump in and sort of pitch for the guy a little bit to say, you know, he had some of
I think Monica did highest. All the pitching that he needed.
Yeah, but he did have some very good approval ratings. But I know we digress and move history a bit. But, you know, I mean, a lot of it, you know, I suppose I sort of know, you know, there's a lot of American history tied up in the naming of ships today in the American Navy that, you know, you can clearly trace the lineage of the name directly back to the War of Independence.
That's true, and I've looked, and I have found no Cornwallis High School anywhere here in the state.
But there are, you know, I mean, for me, you know, there's plenty of ships that I know are named after, you know, some of the generals or some of the military leaders and some of the, you know, historic event places. You know, they're a sort of history of the U.S. of the U.S. Navy. You can sort of trace them and say, right, well, this, you know, where this name, you know. You know, aircraft carriers called the Lexington and things like that. You just know where their name came from. It's obvious.
That's true. Now, speaking of something that might not be so obvious, as we wrap this up here, my hope is that someday they're going to put this episode of the Above Politics show into the ATS time cap. So if we're fortunate enough and that happens to be the case, what would you like to say to Britons in the future about your view of 1776 as seen from here in 2008?
I'll go with a flippant one first. Don't make the Americans suffer when they come back and ask to be part of the empire. Just be gracious and thank them. No, and of course, send all the hate mail to Justin, not to me. No, that's the flippant answer, and I was saving it up for a while. I suppose I'd sort of turn around and say, history has a way of repeating itself. Look at what happened in 1776. Look at what's happening in 2008 around the world. And just think, if you want to get a barometer of what happened, the good things and the bad things. And I suppose that is an interesting point here. And I know we're trying to wrap is, you know, perception-wise, what bad things came out of the War of Independence. You know, you can't really say there was one fundamental bad thing that came out of it. So I suppose you have to look at it and say, you know, massive change in a country, in a culture, doesn't necessarily have to be seen as a bad thing. It can be seen as a good thing when you think about, you know, the ideals and concepts of democracy that were enshrined in what the founding fathers were trying to do, that had an impact throughout the world in the fact that, you know, in great many countries throughout the world, anybody over a certain age has the ability to vote. It's not restricted by their gender, their color, their race, their social position. And these were the kind of things that the founding fathers were trying to do. So I think you have to say that kind of monumental change doesn't necessarily have to be a negative. It can be seen as a very positive thing. And maybe we need to look at things that are going on today and say, just because we feel nervous about them today doesn't mean that in 200, 300 years time we're not going to look back and say, actually, that was a good thing that happened. So I'd say look back, realize the good things that came out of the War of Independence, in the fact that, you know, a great proportion of the world has what we call as a true democracy, where, you know, anybody over the age of 21, 18 or whatever it is can vote and it's not restricted.
Wow. Well, you're far more gracious to the future than I intend to be. My message to the future is very simple and to the point. To my fellow Americans, I say that we have given government a boot in the butt on two different major occasions. We also went to two separate world wars to put down tyrannical governments. So if I learn anything at all from the events of 1776, is that we should not put up with tyrannical government on our own shores, and I hope that the people of the future will take the necessary steps when the time comes, whether it's with ballots or otherwise, to do what it takes to preserve all of those lofty and marvelous things that Martin just talked about.
I was going to say, if you agree or disagree with anything that Justin and I have said, and we'll find it very hard, Justin, there won't be people out there who will either be nodding their heads when one of us is speaking or shaking their heads and shouting and wanting to throw whatever electronic gadget they're using to listen to this on. Come to the show thread, Tell us what you think. If you disagree with us, tell us. If you agree with us, tell us. Let us know what you think about this one, because it's affected us all. Since 1776, all of our lives have been impacted by what the Founding Fathers did.
There you go. And with that in mind, that is a wrap. This has been a special edition of the Above Politics show. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you later. I am Justin Case.
And I'm Martin Bain.
Being part of the revolution is easy. Star, flag, and dig the mother. Whether you find a great topic or really enjoy one of our podcasts, you can make it even better by taking the time to show your appreciation and applause by giving the material a star, then flag, and finally a dig. This will draw attention to the thread or podcast, and by doing so, you're making a difference and improving the ATS, BTS, and Above Politics experience. So remember, when you find a great thread or podcast, star, flag, and dig the mother. Thanks for being part of the revolution from your friends at the Above Networks, LLC.
You've been listening to the Above Politics show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.